This is number 7 in the series on Hilchos Tshuva of the Rambam. Okay, I'm going to skip to chapter 5, where the Rambam starts to discuss general philosophical background and underpinnings of tshuva. Some of the material some of you have heard from me on other occasions. You'll see now where it comes from. We'll see how far we get. He says, Rishus is given to all persons if he wants to incline himself to a good way and be tzaddik, righteous, then the reshus is in his hand. And if he wants to incline himself to an evil way and be evil, the reshus is in his hand. Now, here you'll be very careful. The word reshus is ordinarily translated as permission. Here it cannot mean permission. No one has permission to be wicked. Here, Rishus means power. He's given the power to act in whatever way he will choose. And the Rambam states this in an unlimited way. And he echoes this in other writings as well. It seems the Rambam pictures our free will as unlimited. Whatever I'm physically capable of doing or mentally capable of doing, my will is capable of choosing and carrying out. That's not at all obvious. We normally think of ourselves as having all sorts of limitations. We have habits. We have desires. We have emotions. To think that it's really within my power to decide to overcome all my previous habits and all my previous and all my desires and temptations just by an act of will is not at all obvious, and not everyone agrees to this. But this does seem to be the Rambam's position, that free will is really absolute. And this will have ramifications. Now he quotes a verse from the Torah and gives it a very, I would say, almost unique interpretation. Here, leave out the blue books and I'll show you what the verse says, at least in one natural way of reading it, and then we'll see how the Rambam takes it. On page 19. After they eat from the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Verse 22. Shem God said, behold, man has become like the unique one among us, knowing good and bad. In the Hebrew, the English here has put in a little extra. In the Hebrew it says, Hein ha'adam ha'yo ka'achad bimenu, which could be read, behold, man has become like one of us, knowing good and evil. Of course, God is speaking. One wonders what he means when he says, man became like one of us. There's a whole committee upstairs. They all know good and evil. So your translator writes, became like the unique one among us. In other words, he's only like one, not like the whole group. That sort of eliminates the problem, who the group is. Who do I care who the group is if he only became like one of them? The Rambam suggests reading the verse this way. Behold, man has become like one, comma. Ka'achad, he's become like one. Like one? Like one what? Says the Rambam, it means unique. He's become like one, meaning unique and different from everything else. Putting a comma after like one. And then it goes on. Mimen ladas tov v'ra, knowing good and evil from himself. Man has become unique that he has the internal ability to know what is good and what is evil. He knows it from himself. From his own understanding, he can determine what is good and what is evil. Now, the Rambam writes this, as I will read to you in the Mishnah Torah. Unklus, the Aramaic translation that goes back 2,000 years to a Roman Ger, says exactly the same thing. Now, whatever you think about the Rambam's philosophical underpinnings, but that Unklus writes exactly the same thing, it's really quite striking. Unklus writes, Ha Adam have a yechidi ba'alma, man is unique in the world, mine from himself, lemida tov v'bish, knowing good and evil. Says the Rambam, who should kosu b'Torah? This is what's written in the Torah. And he cites the verse, Kolomar, that is to say, behold, this species of Adam is unique in the world, and there's no other species like him in this respect, that he, from himself, with his own knowledge, with his own thought, knows good and evil. He knows good and evil from his own understanding and does everything that he desires to do. Nothing stops him from doing the good or the evil. And therefore, the verse goes on to say, God wants him to be out of the Garden of Eden. Now, this idea that man knows from himself good and evil, the Rambam is writing it black and white. Unklus translates the verse in the same way. I have 16 sources. 16 Torah sources that are on my website, though they are listed there in Hebrew, because the writings are all in Hebrew, where this idea is expressed, that man knows on his own the difference between good and evil. This idea has enormous ramifications. It's not a simple idea at all, and if you talk to people who aren't aware of the sources, even if they wear two-layered black yarmulkes and wear black hats, they may be surprised at this idea. They may even think that the idea is a kind of heresy. Because if man knows from himself what is good and what is evil, then from himself he could pass judgment on what is good and what is evil. And theoretically, he could even pass judgment on God that what God does is good or evil. And many don't want to take that chance. Many don't want to even consider that thought. They want to say, good and evil are created by God. When he says something, he makes it good. When he says something's bad or forbids it, he makes it evil. He's the source of all good and evil. How could man know independently of God what is good and evil? How could man pass judgment on what is good and what is evil? Nevertheless, that's what the Rambam says here quite explicitly. I, you'll ask. But this was only after eating from the tree. Only after eating from the tree did he have the knowledge of good and evil. Before he ate from the tree, he didn't have the knowledge of good and evil. So, was he less? Did eating from the tree elevate him? Give him some special distinction that he didn't have before he ate from the tree? Wouldn't that be peculiar that by rebelling against God, he should be elevated to the point of coming to understand good and evil, and before that not have it? The Rambam asks this question explicitly in the second chapter of the Guide of the Perplexed. And there he answers. Before man ate from the tree, he had something superior to the knowledge of good and evil. Something more profound, more accurate, more realistic, called the knowledge of emes and sheker, which is wrongly translated as true and false in your dictionaries. He had the knowledge of emes and sheker. When he ate from the tree, he lost that clear perception of emes and sheker, and it was replaced by good and evil. Good and evil are pale, confused, and somewhat inaccurate echoes of emes and sheker. Emes and sheker is superior in reality, in clarity, in depth. He lost that and he got good and evil. I'll explain a little bit. That chapter deserves to be studied and studied, read over and over again. It's full of very important material. But I'll tell you a little bit. God commanded Adam, don't eat from the tree. Now let's think. You give a command. To whom do you give a command? You don't give a command to a computer or to a light switch. You don't give a command to a person who's asleep or a person who's hypnotized. You probably don't give commands to addicts who can't control their behavior. You don't give a command in English to a person who only speaks Chinese. What does giving a command imply? When is it relevant? You don't give commands to dogs, although you may train them to do what you say, but it's not strictly speaking a command. To give a command means the one you're giving it to understands. He appreciates that his actions now have consequences. He understands the appropriateness of fulfilling the command and the inappropriateness of violating the command. All that's built into giving a command. If it isn't there, then giving the command is empty, meaningless. It's a waste. The very fact that God commanded Adam means that Adam was capable of understanding the command, appreciating that it's appropriate to fulfill the command and not violate it. Notice I use the word appropriate. Appropriate, whatever appropriate means. Appropriate is a very general word, a very vague word, and I chose it on purpose because I don't want to pin myself down. I don't want to commit myself to exactly what it means. Emes and sheker enable a person to determine, to understand what it's appropriate to do, what's inappropriate to do. The command is coming from God. He understands that, and he says if it's coming from God, it represents the ultimately real, the ultimately important, the ultimate priority. He understands all of that. Eats from the tree, and he's demoted to a position where he can judge what should be done and what shouldn't be done, but the way he perceives it is very different. The way he understands it is very different. And he can't see clearly anymore, can't understand clearly anymore. Although he can make similar judgments, but his picture of how the judgments are made is an entirely different picture. I'll give you an example. I have this from one of my great teachers, Rabbi Moshe Meiselman. I went through this chapter with him recently. Maimonides writes in a responsum an unbelievable event that happened to him. He wrote this Mishneh Torah, full of the laws of the Torah, when he was quite a bit older. Someone asked him for the source of a law. The Rambam doesn't write any of his sources in this book. The Rambam said, oh, it's in the tractate Makos. Took it out, looked for it, couldn't find it. Oh, he said, it must be in Sanhedrin. And he went through all of Sanhedrin and couldn't find it. At which point the visitor left. So he pulled down another tractate, I think it was Gittin, and he went through it, he found it. He went and he sent someone to run after him in the street and bring him back. I found the source. The Rambam says, listen to this. That was the first time in my life that I ever forgot anything. Until then, I didn't know what it was to forget. That's why I didn't write my sources. Because I was sure that anyone who will read it, the sources will leap instantly to his mind. Oh, of course, I wrote that. It's over there. The first time in his life he experienced forgetting, it was a revelation to him. So a person could read this and not, and the connections wouldn't be made. Now, imagine a person who never forgot anything. So everything he sees, everything he hears, all the associations leap instantly to mind. He sees everything in context. He has an unbelievable clarity. Now he starts to lose that, starts to forget. He knows when he looks now, he's not seeing the picture. He's only getting a fragment. And he can't recover that picture. He's lost it. So he knows that his judgments now are incomplete. They could be biased because he's only seeing part of the picture. The part is not seen. Whereas when you see the whole picture in front of you, it's very hard to picture what it's like to be missing part of the picture and knowing that you're missing part of the picture. This is an example, a crude analogy. The Rambam writes, when before they ate from the tree and they had Emes and Sheker in front of them, they couldn't imagine judging on the basis of good and evil. Because judging on the basis of good and evil is like judging in a fog. If you've never been in a fog, you don't know what it's like. On the other hand, once you're submerged in the fog, the sunlight is obscured. You can't see it anymore. You can't get back there. So each one prevents understanding the other one. If you have Emes and Sheker in front of you, the fog is impossible to imagine. And if you're in the fog, you've lost contact with Emes and Sheker. At any rate, where we stand today, we have good and evil. We don't have Emes and Sheker the way they had it. We have it to some extent, but not the way they had it. In both cases, the Emes and Sheker pair before they ate and the good and evil pair after they ate, both indicate what it is appropriate to do, what it's inappropriate to do, but the way you make the judgment is an entirely different matter. I'll give you another example. This really happened. I don't know if you heard of Oliver Sacks, the great, great neurologist. He reports an example of a person who was a painter, and was quite a successful painter, had showings of his paintings. He had an automobile accident, which injured some part of his brain, where he lost his color perception. Couldn't see colors anymore. Not only couldn't see colors, but he stopped dreaming in color. There's nothing to do with the retina in the eye. It's a higher brain function. And after some months, he couldn't imagine colors. Couldn't imagine them anymore. The whole color part of his consciousness was wiped out. He went into a depression. He's a painter. You know, it's not a person like this who drives a train or as a mathematician. What's a painter going to do if color is gone from his experience? Just gone. Can't see them, can't imagine them, can't think them. He started to go out in the sort of dusk, in the brilliant sunshine. He knew what he was missing. There was all that color there and he couldn't, you know, he was getting something terribly impoverished. He went out in dusk where the missing color didn't bother him so much. And he gradually became sensitive to black, white, and gray. And then he started painting in black, white, and gray. Just like there are black and white photographs, which, as my wife taught me, are much more dramatic than color photographs. Because a black and white photograph, you have to project into it, because the color isn't there. Whereas a color photograph, you can be totally passive. You just sit there and look at it and you see it. And the drama in photography is very often in black and white. And he came to paint in black and white. Some years later, they pioneered an operation which could possibly have restored his color vision, and he refused to take it. He refused to take it because he said, I've been introduced to a new world, the black and white world, which I never appreciated before, and I'm working as an artist to render it, to express it. I don't want to be distracted by color. So when he was able to perceive color, the nuances of black and white were hidden from him. The color just monitored his consciousness. When he lost color, then he became sensitive to the black and white. He couldn't imagine color anymore. Color was wiped out of his consciousness. And then when the opportunity to go back to color, he was afraid he would lose the sensitivity to the black and white and refused to take it. Fascinating, fascinating story. Anyway, so we shouldn't think that having eaten from the tree, they got good and evil, had to step up
And before that, they didn't have it, so they benefit from eating from the tree. No. It wasn't a step up, it was a step down from the position of Emerson Sheker. At any rate, the Rambam says that a person has, with his own understanding, dato and machshavto, his understanding and his thought, he knows what is good and what is evil. Now, I said to you, I'm not going to do all of this, the 16 different sources, but I said to you, this raises the possibility of judging what God does as good and evil. Well, there's a verse in Psalms, which those who daven say every day, Tam u'ru ki tov Hashem. Taste and see that God is good. Taste and see that God is good. That verse challenges us. Yes, take a look, analyze what you see, and you'll come to the conclusion that God is good. This is telling us to make such a judgment. Correct? You have the problem of the suffering of the righteous. Tzadik v'ra'lo. Why is that a problem? It's a problem because we believe we understand what a righteous person is, and we believe that he shouldn't suffer, and therefore we have a problem. Nowhere in our literature does it say, fool, that's not a problem. Who are you to pass judgment? You can't make up your mind about that. Do you really know what good is? Do you really know what righteousness is? Do you really know what evil is? You don't know anything. Nowhere in our literature does it say that. What it does is give explanations. Takes for granted that the problem is a genuine problem, a problem that we very well can understand, and we can get some kind of answer for it. So, indeed, we do have this ability to make judgments about good and evil. We have it on the basis of our very nature. Now, having said all of that, which is just a slice of a much bigger pie, let me point out something that's very important here. When we judge about a particular real circumstance, a real event, or a real institution, real action, and we judge whether it's good or bad, our judgment is based on two different sources. It's based on our understanding of good and bad on the one hand, and our understanding of the action, of the facts of the action on the other hand. And you need both bases to make your judgment. And the judgment can be right or wrong depending upon either of those two factors. I saw Peter pull a gun and shoot Paul between the eyes and kill him dead. Was that good or bad? Right or wrong? Just or unjust? Well, it might depend upon whether Paul pulled first. If Paul already pulled his gun out and was going to shoot at Peter, then Peter's shooting in self-defense. This has nothing to do with your moral principles. Cold-blooded murder is wrong. Self-defense is permissible. Indeed, in our tradition, self-defense is good and right. So, judging what Peter did depends a lot on the facts. If you don't know the facts, it's very hard to judge. You attack a person's judgment, it may be because you think he got the facts wrong. So, the fact that I know what good and evil are doesn't mean that when I judge a particular case in real life, I'll get it right, because I may have the facts wrong. And that typically is the type of answer that's given when something happens in the world, and we know the world is under divine providence, and what happens seems to be terrible, and we wonder, how could God allow such a thing to happen in his world? What we are told is that we don't have the facts right. We don't see where the thing came from. We don't see where the thing is going. We don't see all of its ramifications. And therefore, our judgment that this particular concrete event is bad is a mistake. Nor does it say your whole concept of right and wrong is inappropriate. You know, maybe right, maybe good is marshmallows, or petunias, or space-time, or black holes or something. No, nowhere is such a suggestion made. Of course you know what good is, and of course you know what bad is, within limits of accuracy. But this item you're talking about, you don't know whether it's good or bad. So, because you don't know what its consequences are. So, the fact that I have the ability to understand good and evil doesn't mean that my concrete judgments are going to be right. Now let's take washing your hands three times before you eat bread, twice however many times you wash, right? I say,
but my hands are already clean. You know, that's just a waste.
Waste of water.
A country like Israel where we count drops of water. You know, it's just pointless. Well, maybe yes and maybe no. If you were aware that the creator of the universe wants you to do that, then you might think differently about it. Your judgment that it's a waste is based on your picture of the facts. No one's going to attack your value system. What they'll say is you don't have all the facts. You're just missing part of the facts. Once you know that the Creator wants you to do it, that's a different fact. All of a sudden, your judgment becomes a different judgment. So you may not be able to trust your knowledge of what good and evil are in making concrete judgments, because the creator of the universe is on record that he wants various things and doesn't want other things. Is there anything wrong with eating a bacon cheeseburger other than the cholesterol and the weight and then all the rest of that, the chemicals that went into it? Well, it depends. If the creator of the universe says don't eat them, then it's wrong. You're unaware of that. You don't know what's wrong. Here, you can't trust your concept of good and evil as applied to concrete circumstances because you don't usually know the relevant facts about the concrete circumstances. That does not contradict what the Rambam says here, that we have the ability to know what good and evil are. And it doesn't contradict, that doesn't contradict the fact that you need to know the Torah in order to know what is right and wrong to do. Okay, now the Rambam goes on to explain this in great detail. Let a person's thought not entertain the idea which fools, both non-Jewish and Jewish, say that God decrees for a person from the beginning of his creation to be either righteous or wicked. That God decrees, he doesn't say predicts, he decrees. In other words, he builds it into the creation. When he creates him, this guy's going to be a bank robber, and this guy's going to give charity, and this guy's going to be a surgeon who'll do free surgery. And this guy is going to embezzle, you know, Enron. He says that's a foolish position, and it is certainly incorrect. It's not so. Rather, every person has the capacity to be righteous as Moses and as wicked as Yeravam, who's one of the wicked kings. Or wise, or foolish, or merciful, or cruel. And the same with all the other character traits. He can make himself into, he says, wise. Even wisdom. That's a very striking statement. Not everybody would agree with that. In other words, if you invest yourself in creating wisdom for yourself, it'll come. No one forces him, and no one decrees on him. No one drags him to one side or the other, the two possibilities. But for himself, from his own understanding, he inclines to whichever way he desires. This is what Jeremiah said. It does not come out from the mouth of the Most High, evils and good. That is to say, the Creator does not decree on the person that he should be good or to do good or to do evil. And therefore, a person who transgresses, he is destroying himself. He causes his own loss. He cannot blame it on God and say, you made me this way.
But he can blame it on his father or his grandfather. Well, not blame him, maybe, but the fault of my life, what of his ancestors.
The fault of what?
Of him, the way you're taught by your parents.
So he's saying, the Rambam is saying, that you have this. The free will includes the power to act in any way that you choose. There are no limitations. The only limitation would be what I told you, the name of Rav Dessler. Suppose no one ever taught him what it's right to do. Then he wouldn't have a choice because he wouldn't know of the option. But and there you will have cases. There you will have cases. Now you can blame your father and grandfather and your whole community if they never taught you what it was right to do. But once he's been taught what it's right to do and he knows there's an option, then nothing can stop him from choosing the right option.
When one attains the knowledge, when one attains the foundation, Torah, and decides to not follow it, decides to throw away certain facets of it, then I understand that I understand that's an object of free will. But when one is raised without that knowledge,
yeah,
and doesn't have that knowledge,
yeah,
and, you know, kind of curtails some of those obligations, then he's not a, that's not, there's no equivalency there.
100% correct. 100% correct. If you don't know, you can't be held responsible. This is my example of doctors who 150 years ago bled people when they had fevers because that was considered to be the best medical practice. We do not condemn them. They just didn't know that it was bad for their patients. They did the best that they could. But once you know, says the Rambam, nothing can stop your free will from choosing. As I told you, not everyone would agree with this, but that's his position. Yeah.
The fact that he grew up in a religious household is not free will.
Well, it's not free will. The Rambam would say that it is free will. And even if you are trained in a habit to do something, he would say, you do have the free choice not to follow the habit.
Just contradicts what you said in the second.
Why?
So that somebody doesn't know about it and they don't have the free will, they can't be held accountable. But once
the person is, yes.
You know about it, then they have free will, whether you can keep that.
Right. So what?
If someone
is raised in a religious household, then what?
You might not know
this. What's the
free will.
Why? No. Let's get this straight. This is very important. I know people. You don't sound like you're an American, so you may not be able to imagine what American Jews are, many of them. I know people who, American Jews who grow up, have never heard the word kosher. Never heard the word, ever. They haven't the slightest idea that of a soul. They haven't the slightest idea that God is a reality. They know absolutely nothing. They really know nothing. Now, you say to this person, you lit fires on Saturdays? How could you do that? I think, well, what's wrong with that? I light fires on Mondays, and I light fires on Thursdays, and I light fires on Saturdays. You know, what could be wrong with that? That person has never heard of Shabbos, never heard of it. So you can't say he has free will with respect to Shabbos, and he's going to be responsible for not keeping Shabbos. He never heard of Shabbos. Okay. I think here we're on the same ground. Now let's take a person who grows up in a religious household. Right? He's taught to keep Shabbos. He also knows that there are other people who are not keeping Shabbos, unless he's secluded someplace. But the vast majority of people who grow up in religious households know there are other people, even Jews, who are not keeping Shabbos. So he knows there are two possibilities. Keep Shabbos and not to keep Shabbos. He knows on Shabbos he doesn't drive a car and the cars are whizzing by in front of his house and some of the people driving those cars are Jews. So he knows there are two options, keeping Shabbos and not keeping Shabbos. Once he knows there are two options, then he has free will to choose either option and therefore he's responsible for the choice that he makes, and if he makes the right choice, he deserves credit for it. So being raised in a religious household increases your options and it increases your free will. And you certainly are responsible for what you're doing. Are we on the same page now? Okay, if something's wrong, I'll be glad to hear what the problem is. Only if you had a person who grew up in an area which was so totally isolated that everybody there kept Shabbos and the person never heard of anybody not keeping Shabbos, then you could say the person would know that there isn't such an option. But even there, anything that requires an effort, anything for which you have a desire to do otherwise, to say that he doesn't have another option, you know, he knows very well. They say, you ate meat, don't eat milk for 6 hours. But the milk is in the refrigerator. He knows how to get it and drink it. It's not difficult. So he knows there's an option of physically doing it. It's very hard to hide that from him. Okay. Therefore, since if a person transgresses, he did it himself, it's appropriate for him to cry and to bewail to the Konein. Translate Konein into English. To mourn his sins, what he did to himself, what he caused himself. Quotes another verse. I told you, in this he quotes verses for every move here. And then, since He still has free will. He hasn't lost his free will. Committed the crime. It's appropriate for him to turn around and say, since I do have free will, and I did all these things from my own choice, it's appropriate to do tshuva, to abandon my evil, because the power is in my hand now just as it was before. As the verse says. And this is the fundamental principle and the pillar of the Torah and the commandments. And he quotes another verse. Behold, I've set before you this day life and death. That man has the power to choose whatever he chooses. That's what he will do, good or evil. Now, he says, why is this important? Because, this is halacha adalah, we're up to paragraph 4 already. Had God decreed upon man to be righteous or evil, or had there been something that draws him in the nature of his creation, from birth to one of the various ways, or one of the types of understanding and types of action, as these foolish people imagine, how could God command us via his prophets, do this and don't do that? If a person's already programmed from birth, behave one way or another, to command him, do this or do that, is an exercise in futility. You don't command squirrels, and you don't command your computer, they're not listening. These people say that from your birth, you're programmed to behave one way or another. So what would be the point of saying to him, do this or do that? Improve your ways, analyze your actions, do tshuva, all these types of commands would be senseless. And what room would there be for the whole Torah? With what justice, with what judgment would God punish the wicked or give reward to the righteous? Shall the judge of the earth not do justice? Here he comes to what many people feel is a fundamental reason why free will is important. Because only if a person makes a free decision is he responsible for what he does. Can you judge him morally and say what he did was good or was evil? Hold him responsible, and if he's evil, punish him. And if he's good, reward him. We'll explain in a minute why the evil side comes before the good side. If a person, I'll put it neutrally, if he moves in a certain way, and that motion is not a result of his free will, then saying he did well or poorly, is good or bad, righteous or vicious, is ridiculous. It's ridiculous. It has no relevance to him. And then reward and punishment, which are cornerstones of Jewish religion, would be unjust. Would be unjust. I'll give you an example. Reuven is standing at the top of a flight of stairs, looking down the stairs. Shimon sneaks up behind him, and he gives him a push, and Reuven tumbles down the stairs, and there's a 5th century Ming vase at the bottom of the stairs, and Reuven's body smashes into the Ming vase and destroys it. You are the owner of the erstwhile Ming vase, which is now in shattered pieces. Who are you going to charge for the loss of your vase? Reuven, whose body smashed it, or Shimon, who pushed him? Shimon, obviously. Why? Because Reuven didn't choose to smash the vase. He was just a tool in the hands of Shimon, who gave him a push. Reuven is walking down the street, and there's a sudden loud noise, which frightens him, and he jumps, and he bangs into you. Are you going to blame him for banging into you? He didn't anticipate the noise. He didn't decide to jump. It was just an instinctive reaction. You can't blame him for that. Why? Because he didn't choose to bang into you. People are only responsible when they make choices. If they don't make choices, they're not responsible. A kills B. How does A kill B? A's driving his car. A child darts out in front of his car. He turns quickly to the left in order to try to avoid hitting the child and hits somebody who's standing on the left who we didn't see. Would you charge the driver with manslaughter? Would you put him in jail? He was trying to avoid hitting a child, and he succeeded, and he hit somebody else instead whom he didn't see. He didn't choose to hit the person. So to punish him would be grossly unjust, since he didn't choose to do what he did. Yeah?
I have a question for you. In the American legal system, criminal law, it's called actus reus. It's the voluntary facet of the crime that's necessary
to be
charged with that particular crime. Now, what happens in Jewish law if you have the requisite mental state where you think you're committing a crime, but it's not a crime? You understand? So,
is it because
you're committing a burglary, for example?
Yeah.
You have the requisite mental state, but it doesn't fit the definition of burglary. And I'm just saying burglary.
Yeah.
You can say X. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
X commandment. Now what happens in that? The individual has the requisite mental state, where he's walking into the house to commit a burglary. He's walking into the house to, I don't know, disavow some commandment. But, you know, for some factual impossibility.
So let's just be very clear what you're talking about here. There are two ways in which you can make a mistake. One way is that he's ignorant of the law, and the other is ignorant of the circumstances. You're making it sound like his knowledge of the law is fine. It's just that in other words, he's going in to commit a burglary, but it happens to be an abandoned house that's ownerless, and the materials there are ownerless and are free for anybody to take.
I'm just trying to see the contrast between, yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
So I hope in American law, I think in any legal system, cannot punish him for committing a crime. He didn't commit a crime. Right? Now, I think in American law, for mere intent will not carry any penalty. Though you might want to be careful about him, you know, you might want to have him followed or something for the next time. But I don't think you can punish him directly. We too can't punish him directly, but he'll come under punishment from God for his bad intent. And what you're really raising is a much deeper and broader category called moral luck, which is a gigantic subject in secular philosophy, and to a certain extent in law. A takes the gun, shoots the gun, and kills B. C takes the gun, shoots the gun with perfect aim, and the wind blows the bullet to the side and misses D. If you look at A and C, they're equal. Each one picked up a gun and shot it at a victim in order to kill him. In C's case, the wind blew it aside. Lucky C. He's not going to jail. It's at best attempted murder. But why should my judgment about A and C be affected by a matter over which neither had control? The wind? How can the wind make C less of a criminal than A? Here, it's a classic case where, on the one hand, I say A committed murder and C didn't. He didn't kill anybody. How can you hold him responsible for murder when he didn't kill anybody? On the other hand, looking at what A and C did, they did exactly the same thing. C was just lucky that the wind blew his bullet to the side and he didn't kill anybody. Shouldn't they be judged the same morally? It's an unanswered contradiction in our moral intuitions in secular philosophy. Although legally, of course, you put the one in jail now. But the question is, which one is a worse person? Which one is a more evil person? And I think we have contradictory intuitions about this. In Jewish law, in Jewish perspective, the picture looks entirely different. The outcome of your decisions is never up to you. You don't control how the world operates, ever. If the bullet flies true, you didn't control that. And if the wind blows it aside, you didn't control that. So the consequences are only a signal from God how he wants this person to be treated. If the bullet flies true, it means God wants him treated as a murderer. If the bullet is blown to the side, it means God wants to give him another chance or wants him to be able to do something else. And that's why he prevented him from being regarded as a murderer. Whereas from the point of view of the person's own evil, they really are equivalent. They really are equivalent. The consequences do not determine at all the evil of the person, because the consequences are never up to us. Right, so from our point of view, because we have an extra factor in the picture, namely divine providence, the same dilemma doesn't arise. That doesn't solve the dilemma in secular philosophy. The dilemma in secular philosophy is how to solve it without putting God into the picture. Just pointing out that in our context, it doesn't arise at all. That's the broader context in which your question really deserves to be. At any rate, so the Rambam says here, if we thought that man was determined in his actions, then reward and punishment would be unjust. Now, I'll just end with one little footnote. Why does he put punishing the wicked first and rewarding the righteous second? Because there's a little twist of subtlety here. If a person doesn't choose freely to do what he does, punishing him for bad actions is ridiculous. It's unjust. You're punishing a person for something which you didn't choose to do. That's straightforward immoral.